This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Jude Shapiro. I'm following the chaplains of Heathrow Airport. I'll be discovering what happens when faith, flight, and the stresses of Europe's busiest airport combine.
People are so often placed in our path just at the right time.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello and welcome to NewsHour from the BBC World Service. We're coming to you live from London. I'm James Menendez. And we're going to begin with that news just in the past hour or so that the International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, his former Defence Minister Yoav Gallant and the Hamas military chief Mohammed Deif over the war in Gaza. Prosecutors asked the ICC to issue the warrants back in May of this year, but Israel challenged its jurisdiction. The court has now rejected that appeal. Well, let's speak to the BBC's Frank Garner, who joins us on the line from Jerusalem. Frank, just tell us, what are the charges exactly against these three?
Right. Well, the charges are for crimes against humanity and war crimes, primarily. Drilling down into it, it's for accusations of starvation in Gaza Strip, where Israel has been fighting a pretty intense conflict ever since the October the 7th raid by Hamas-led militants last year. And when it comes to Mohammed Deif, whose real name is Ibrahim al-Masri, he is accused of murder, sexual violence, and other activities. But he's almost certainly dead. The Israelis presume that he was killed in August. So that one is a little unclear. And initially, Yahya Sinwar, the military leader at the time and then later leader of Hamas, was being sought, as was Ismail Haniyeh, but they are both dead. So this has provoked a furious reaction here in Israel. From the president downwards, the prime minister's office, they've called it absurd and unwarranted, a dark day for justice, double standards. Have we learnt nothing from the Allied victory over the Nazis, etc.? So there's a right across the political spectrum here in Israel, there is a very angry reaction to this.
And although you say that Mohammed Deif is almost certainly dead, we've had a statement, I think, from Hamas, slightly bizarre, welcoming the move by the ICC.
Well, they're welcoming it because they want to see Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former Defence Minister Yoav Gallant being dragged, kicking and screaming to the Hague. And I think it's worth pointing out that the war in Gaza goes on, and in the last 24 hours, reportedly at least 60 people have been killed, mostly civilians, if not all civilians, and most of those in the Beit Lahia area of northern Gaza. So airstrikes are continuing there, you know, more than 13 months after this conflict began, triggered by the murderous raid into southern Israel by Hamas on October the 7th last year. Reportedly over 44,000 Palestinians have been killed. And every day brings more to that death toll. And the conditions in Gaza are absolutely atrocious. This is largely and frequently denied by the Israeli authorities, but it's quite clear that not enough aid is getting through. The situation is exacerbated by local looters who, as you've probably heard in the last few days, have been ambushing food aid convoys, stealing the contents, sometimes the lorries themselves. These are criminal gangs, Bedouin gangs, operating inside the Gaza Strip. But the situation in northern Gaza is particularly bad because the hospitals there are barely functioning. Hospital staff are having to get people out from the rubble with their own hands. They haven't got ambulances. There's no civil defence left. And winter is fast approaching, where there will be rains forecast even in the coming in the next week, which will make things absolutely dire.
Yeah, and we're going to be hearing a bit more about conditions in northern Gaza a little later in the programme. Frank, for the moment, thank you very much indeed. The BBC's Frank Gardner joining us live from Jerusalem. Let's talk to Janina Dill, who's co-director of the Oxford University Institute for Ethics, Law and Armed Conflict, and joins us on the line. Thanks very much for being with us here on NewsHour. Let's just deal with some of the sort of finer aspects of these arrest warrants. Israel's not a signatory to the ICC, but is it nevertheless potentially a big problem for the government, these two arrest warrants?
Well, it should ideally be a problem from a legal perspective, because all members of the Rome Statute, 124 countries, now have a legal obligation to arrest Prime Minister Netanyahu, former Defence Minister Gallant, or indeed Mohammed Deif. This should mean concretely that these individuals cannot travel to these 124 member states of the Rome Statute without risking being arrested. They can't participate in diplomatic meetings there, but they can also not go there in their personal capacity. It's a bit more complicated when it comes to states that are not members of the Rome Statute, for instance, the United States. They're called upon to cooperate with the court, but they don't have this legal obligation. Of course, all states, whether they are members of the Rome Statute or not, may take note that a competent international court has found reasonable grounds to suspect that the Israeli head of government has committed war crimes and crimes against humanity. Netanyahu is still directing the war in Gaza. The conduct at the center of this arrest warrant persists. So this quite strongly implies that any material or diplomatic support for Israel's war in Gaza risks supporting war crimes and crimes against humanity, which may be one of the pieces of information that states take into account when deciding whether they can actually support Israel's war in Gaza.
Right, with weapons and so on, right. So that's another ramification. But in terms of carrying out the arrests, as you say, so it's up to individual signatory states as to whether they do that. And in the past, even though people have signed up to the ICC, they haven't always carried out those arrest warrants. Is that right?
Yeah, I imagine that Netanyahu will be careful not to travel to any of the relevant countries or at least seek diplomatic assurances before traveling. So it is not terribly likely that he will end up in The Hague anytime soon. But this doesn't mean that the arrest warrants are meaningless. They should over time have diplomatic and political consequences for Israel's geopolitical position and its ability to carry out these military operations in the region. You are, of course, right that in the past, even signatories to the Rome Statute haven't always discharged their obligation to arrest individuals that the court has been seeking. So cooperation with the court is anything but perfect.
And how long do these arrest warrants last? I mean, are they in perpetuity?
Yeah, they don't get like automatically vacated. There's a question also whether they can sometimes proceed past. There's generally a notion that they don't, that people are not tried in absentia, but there's also the notion that they could proceed further so that they could cause ongoing diplomatic problems for particularly someone like Netanyahu, who remains in post.
I mean, so is it your assessment that it's very unlikely that these two, Benjamin Netanyahu and Yoav Gallant, will end up then in court?
Well, it's hard to speculate, but they would have to make a mistake in some sense in terms of where they travel and how they deal with these arrest warrants. If we think about the precedents, particularly for Benjamin Netanyahu, we have outstanding arrest warrants against, or we had arrest warrants before against sitting heads of states like Omar al-Bashir and currently the Russian President Putin. And they have both managed to kind of diplomatically forestall the possibility of their own arrest so far. And there's no particular reason to assume that they should fail at that in the future.
Janina, thank you very much indeed. That was Janina Dill of Oxford University. Well, I think we can speak now to Alan Baker, who's a former legal counsel for the Israeli military and also the Israeli Foreign Ministry. Alan Baker, welcome to NewsHour. First of all, your reaction to the ICC issuing these arrest warrants?
Well, I think this is a sad day for the ICC because it's basically enabled itself to fall into a trap that the Palestinians have been trying to lay for many, many years, to politicize the court that was supposed to be completely neutral and completely independent. And they've turned it basically into their own backyard tribunal for bashing Israel.
Just to be clear, what evidence is there for that?
Well, first of all, the fact that the court doesn't have any jurisdiction to deal with the complaints by the Palestinians, because According to the statute of the court, only states can be party to the statute, and there doesn't exist a Palestinian state. Therefore, the Palestinians can't give over to the court jurisdiction over territory that they claim, because they don't have territory. The whole issue of the status of the territories is still under negotiation and hasn't yet been determined. So the whole concept of the court issuing arrest warrants based on jurisdiction that the Palestinians have given it is a pure fiction, and many states are of this opinion.
Yeah, I'm just looking through the reasons given for why the ICC found these reasonable grounds for the warrants. I mean, it's quite clear that they say international humanitarian law relates directly to this conflict between Israel and Palestine because both, it says, are high contracting parties to the Geneva Conventions of 1949. And on the point that you were making, because Israel occupies at least parts of Palestine. In other words, they're quite clear that they do have jurisdiction.
No, but excuse me, as I tried to explain to you, there's no such thing. There's no Palestinian state. Even the United Kingdom acknowledges the fact that there does not exist a state of Palestine. Therefore, the court can't extend its jurisdiction over territory of a non-existent state. Now, on the question of
But it's saying that effectively that there isn't a state because Israel is occupying that territory. And nevertheless, there are still two parties to an international armed conflict. And therefore, it has the power to get involved and assess whether crimes against humanity have been committed.
No, you're mixing two things. If Israel is occupying territory, this is an issue that's presently under a peace process, a peace negotiation process, and it's not an issue that can be solved by the International Criminal Court. That's not the purpose of the International Criminal Court. It doesn't resolve differences between international states or entities or whatever. That's one issue.
But it is trying to assess whether crimes against humanity have been committed. And one of the reasons for the court's existence is if allegations of those crimes are not being investigated at a national level, and that isn't happening, is it?
It is happening. This is exactly the point. This is one of the issues in the statute of the International Criminal Court, and I was involved in drafting that statute, that if the state involved is capable and willing to investigate any allegations or claims of violations of the laws of armed conflict or international humanitarian law, then the court has got absolutely no jurisdiction to deal with this.
But there's no Israeli warrant for Benjamin Netanyahu out, is there?
But Israel doesn't need to issue a warrant against Netanyahu. All Israel needs to do is to investigate any claims that violations have taken place of international humanitarian law. And this is what Israel is doing.
Okay. Alan Baker, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Former legal counsel for the Israeli military and the Israeli foreign ministry joining us live. As I mentioned a little earlier, we will be returning to the war in Gaza later in the programme. We're going to be talking to an aid worker inside the territory about the worsening situation there, particularly when it comes to that issue of food shortages. You're listening to NewsHour. Coming up later in the programme, the Oscar-winning actress Michelle Yeoh explains how her training in ballet helped her to become a martial arts star in Hong Kong action films.
I looked at the whole action sequences and I thought, that's very similar to dance. It's all choreography. You know, you choreograph it and then you perform, execute it. And it's very much like dancing. It's to a rhythm with a partner or a few partners, and that's how you make this whole thing work.
More from Michelle Yeoh coming up in half an hour. Our main headline once again, the International Criminal Court has issued arrest warrants for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and the former Defence Minister Yoav Gallant for crimes against humanity. A warrant's also been issued for Mohammed Deif, a Hamas leader who's believed to be dead. This is James Menendez with NewsHour live from the BBC. The COP29 climate summit in Azerbaijan is meant to draw to a close on Friday, but as is often the case with these meetings, there's currently deadlock over the shape of a final deal. The summit is supposed to agree on a new target to replace the $100 billion a year that rich nations pledge to help poorer countries fight climate change. One draft suggests that figure could be in the trillions of dollars. Britain and Brazil have been asked to try to come up with a compromise that the nearly 200 countries can sign up to. Our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt, is at the meeting in Baku.
What even is a trillion? A million seconds is 11 and a half days. A billion seconds is 31 years. A trillion seconds is 31,000 years. $1 trillion is a lot of money. So how on earth can you raise that kind of cash? Now, traditionally, you'd pass around the hat, ask developed countries, rich countries, to cough up a bit more. But they only pay developing countries about $40 billion a year in climate finance at the moment.
There is no national security. There is no economic security. There is no global security without climate security.
Sakir was in Baku last week, and like most leaders of rich countries, he's refusing to raise spending on international climate aid. There's a cost of living crisis on, but there are other options.
Every COP must make progress irrespective of the geopolitical dynamics.
Mia Motley, the Prime Minister of Barbados, is leading a reform process.
Rich countries must deliver on their commitments.
She's argued with success that the international development banks, the IMF, the World Bank and others could and should be delivering more money.
These are institutions that were founded post-World War II, where all the governments of the world pool their money.
Joe Thwaites is a climate finance expert with a US environmental group.
With that money and with the backing of all the world's governments, including some with brilliant credit ratings, they can go to private capital markets and borrow money very, very cheaply.
The idea is they could borrow more and therefore lend more out at cheap rates.
You can triple the size of the multilateral development banks. So you could grow them to about $390 billion a year.
Now we're making progress.
Hey, Vera, lovely to meet you.
And that cash could be used to unlock even more money, say a team of eminent economists tasked by the UN with exploring the climate finance issue.
It's a multiplier effect, yes. So you put $1, you get $20 out if you have a guarantee.
Vera Tsongwe from Cameroon is one of those economists. She says we shouldn't forget that there's potentially a lot of profit in clean energy in the developing world. One important reason private investors are wary is interest rates are often far higher there. But a bit of money up front,
it guarantees the investment. It tells the investor there is not going to be any change of policy, change of price, or change of the environment.
Less risk.
But if that happens, I am going to pay you for it happening. Any money that you've lost.
So it takes the risk out.
So it takes the risk away.
And the interest rate falls.
And the interest rate falls.
And then
yes.
Capital flows in. Is that the idea?
And capital flows in.
Tsongwe and her colleagues say this could generate as much as $500 billion a year of private investment in the years after 2030. Can I have a black Americano, please?
Yes.
The food here at COP is really expensive. £6 for a coffee. You could raise some climate finance at those rates.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks.
But we're already well over $900 billion. And there are other, even more innovative ideas bouncing around this conference. Levies on aviation, on shipping, on billionaires. They may be long shots, but each one could raise tens of billions a year. So while a trillion really is a very large amount of money, the prospect of raising it may not be as alarming as it sounds.
That was our climate editor, Justin Rowlatt, reporting from Azerbaijan.
At $5 million for the banana, here it is. These are words I never thought I'd say. $5 million for a banana. Don't let it slip away. 5,100,000.
Yes, you heard it right. A banana stuck to a wall with duct tape has just sold at auction for more than $5 million. The work, if that's what it is, was made by the artist Maurizio Catalan in 2019, one of three original editions, no less. It was called Comedium. Well, the person who stumped up the cash is a crypto entrepreneur called Justin Sun, who's promised to eat the banana before it goes off. Elizabeth Fullerton is an art critic. So, on what planet is a banana taped to a wall worth $5 million?
It's quite a fruity work, if you think about it. It's a phallic symbol. There's a kind of puerile humour to it. But it's also subversive, isn't it? It's a bit like Piero Manzoni's 90 cans of excrement that he made that were supposed to be valued according to their weight in gold. And at the same time, no one even knew if they really were, if they really did have excrement inside them. Here you've got a banana that two people have already eaten, two artists have already eaten, taken off the wall and eaten. I had a banana today for breakfast. You know, it's a pretty normal thing. And I think the artist is poking fun at the art world, at the art market, and saying just how much are people prepared to pay for something really, really ordinary that I've just stuck up on the wall and decided is art.
So the joke is on who? The joke is on the person who bought it, this crypto entrepreneur, is it?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, definitely he's poking fun at the art market and its excesses. But of course, it has a more serious side too. I mean, it's funny, but it's also a little bit grotesque. There's something gross about the idea of paying $6 million or $5 million for a banana taped to a wall. What else could that buy in terms of, think of the food and medicine that could be bought for people in Gaza with that money? Or there's so much that could be done with that money and put to a good cause. But at the same time, this entrepreneur has bought himself 5 minutes in the spotlight in a way. It's kind of buying the hype.
And it's so strange because it is a fresh banana. I mean, it's not even buying something that would last. I mean, thinking about sort of, you know, other provocative art objects that, you know, have raised a lot of money in the past, like the one you mentioned. I was also thinking about Merritt Oppenheim's third cup as well. I mean, these things are objects that will stand the test of the time. But I mean, he said he's going to eat this banana and he'll have to replace it himself. Does that make him part of the artwork then as well, or just a mug?
Personally, I think it makes him a mug, but it's a really perfect artwork for our time. It's a perfect artwork for a world of excess and spectacle, material excess and spectacle. I mean, it will buy him a little bit more fame and time on social media if he films himself eating it. This can run and run. It's not just one banana, as we saw when people did eat it in different art fair booths, you know, and they just replaced it because you're buying the concept. That's straight out of Marcel Duchamp with his fountain from 1917.
Yeah, yes, the urinal that he put on show, more than 100 years ago. I suppose we should say that Maurizio Catalan, who originally taped the banana to the wall, the artist, he won't make that $5 million because it had already been sold for far less than that. But the people who will make the money are the auction house, Sotheby's. I mean, they will make quite a lot of money out of this, won't they?
Yeah, they're laughing all the way to the bank. But that's always the way with auctions.
The London-based art critic Elizabeth Fullerton there. You're listening to NewsHour. Do stay with us. Lots more coming up in the second half of the programme.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Jude Shapiro. I'm following the chaplains of Heathrow Airport. I'll be discovering what happens when faith, flight, and the stresses of Europe's busiest airport combine.
People are so often placed in our path just at the right time.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Welcome back to NewsHour. More now on climate change, because at this year's summit, COP29, experts have been urging countries to prioritise water management in their climate strategies. It's a message that strikes a chord with Cape Town in South Africa, a city that not too long ago was staring at a catastrophic water crisis that left millions without a reliable source of drinking water. But Cape Town managed to turn things around with a series of interventions. The BBC's Akisa Wandera reports on how they did it.
In Imiza Moyetu, an informal settlement in Cape Town, 48-year-old Nobuhle Blai makes the journey to and from a shared water point several times a day.
But just a few years ago, residents here were faced with an unimaginable reality. Day zero, which would have meant that the city would have completely run out of water.
I told my children to use a small container and share the water to wash their faces, and I'll tell them that they must use another container to collect the water they've already used so that we can use it to flush the toilet when going there.
In Hart Bay, a suburban area in Cape Town, Shala Noton, a vegetable farmer, shows us around her farm. Before the drought, water use in suburban areas like Hart Bay was a lot less efficient. Now, Shala and her community are living by new rules: reuse, recycle, and conserve as much as possible.
We've tried to turn our grey water that's relatively clean, that's what we use to water our garden. We've been lucky that we could afford big JoJo tanks. We collect rainwater.
It did not stop at individual level. Cape Town's leadership embraced innovation, tapping into underground aquifers and recycling wastewater to secure its future. The Zandvliet Wastewater Treatment Works processes 90 million litres of water daily. Jordan Hill Lewis is the mayor of Cape Town.
We are investing in new sources of water for Cape Town with the aim of replacing about a third, about 33% of our water need from non-rainfall sources, which will make us much less vulnerable to drought conditions in the coming decades.
One of the city's key strategies is utilizing the vast Table Mountain Aquifer, a hidden reserve deep beneath Cape Town. Professor Kevin Winter is a lead researcher at the University of Cape Town's Future Water Institute.
I think we've seen plenty of cities that are using groundwater. If you go to some of the northern Scandinavian countries, for instance, their water supply is entirely from the ground and highly regulated and controlled and managed. All over Africa, groundwater is well known as a source of water.
Back in Imiza Moyetu, Nobuhle's day is not over. She'll make one more trip to the water point before nightfall. But the shift in her mindset and in her community is irreversible.
That was Akisa Wandera reporting there from Cape Town in South Africa. You're listening to the BBC. This is the BBC World Service in London. You're listening to NewsHour. I'm James Menendez. Well, let's return to the Middle East now and what's happening in Gaza at the moment, because there has been a series of Israeli airstrikes on buildings in northern Gaza in the past 24 hours in a place called Beit Lahia. Local health officials are talking about dozens of people who've been killed or are missing, perhaps as many as 60, although that hasn't yet been confirmed. The Israeli military in a statement said it struck what it called Hamas terrorist infrastructure in Beit Lahia, saying that steps were taken to lessen the risk to civilians. But as well as bombs, there is another grave risk to people in northern Gaza, a severe shortage of food, according to a whole host of aid agencies still working in what remains a combat zone. I've been talking to Hisham Hanna of the International Committee of the Red Cross, or ICRC. He's in central Gaza, in Deir el-Balah. How would he characterise the humanitarian situation at the moment?
Extremely dire and rapidly deteriorating, in short. Everything we're witnessing from across the Gaza Strip is nothing but alarming, particularly in the northern governorate of Gaza, where civilians for several weeks have been suffering from shortage of food, drinking water supplies. They are living in constant fear amidst explosions and displacement with no proper access to functional hospitals.
Are people starving to death, would you say? Have you seen any evidence of that?
We haven't seen or witnessed a clear evidence of starvation, yet we are receiving reports, particularly from the hospitals in the Northern Governorate, of a number of cases who died because of acute malnutrition. In general, there's severe hardships in finding flour and bread. We can see long queues of people waiting at bakeries, and especially in light of the trickle of humanitarian aid that is actually entering Gaza and delivered to civilians, it's alarming for the ICRC.
And when you say a trickle of humanitarian aid getting in, how much is actually getting inside Gaza in terms of trucks, for example, or in terms of the sort of weight of food that is getting in every day?
What I can tell you and assure you is that it is not enough. There is no sufficient amount of trucks that enter Gaza, and this is also challenged by a number of factors. First, the absence of law and order system in Gaza. We have witnessed issue of looting of heavy aid trucks, the inaccessibility to certain areas, particularly in the north of Gaza, as well as the vast destruction of roads, infrastructure, and potentially also the risk of exploded ordnances.
So in other words, even if more aid trucks were able to get into Gaza, particularly northern Gaza, it would be, what, almost impossible to get those to the people who need it?
It's highly challenging, and we believe that there is more that can and should be done. Before October 7th, 2023, an average of 500 trucks used to enter Gaza on a daily basis. We have not witnessed even half of this portion entering Gaza in best-case scenario. Israel, as an occupying power, must ensure, according to the international humanitarian law, that civilians have access to all the necessary assistance in terms of food, water, shelter, and, of course, healthcare.
And if people are dying because of malnutrition, they are starving to death, that presumably constitutes a war crime, doesn't it?
What we can assure is that we are gravely concerned about increasing levels of hunger throughout the entire Gaza Strip. And according to international humanitarian law, food cannot be weaponized.
The International Criminal Court has just issued arrest warrants for the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his former defense minister, and also the military chief of Hamas. Is it possible those will make your humanitarian work more difficult?
The work of the ICC and of the ICRC constitute alternative and complementary approaches to preventing IHL violations. We, as ICRC, choose to promote respect for IHL through confidential dialogue and persuasion. And we believe there are alternatives that could bring significant change and immediate change and make life easier for the millions who are currently displaced in Gaza, who are focusing only on surviving day by day.
And that was Hisham Hanna of the International Committee of the Red Cross, the ICRC. He's based in central Gaza. Australia's Parliament has begun debating what the government says is the world's first law designed to stop children under the age of 16 from accessing social media. The new legislation needs to pass both houses before it comes into effect, and the social media giants will have at least a year to come up with ways to prevent children getting onto their sites. Otherwise, they could be fined up to $30 million. From Sydney, Katie Watson reports.
This is about protecting young people, not punishing or isolating them.
Australia's Communications Minister, Michelle Rowland, made the government's position very clear. For too many children, she said, social media is harmful.
This bill seeks to set a new normative value in society, that accessing social media is not the defining feature of growing up in Australia. Yeah. I commend the bill to the House.
Yeah. Politicians are now debating the legislation in Canberra, but it's a discussion being had well beyond the corridors of power.
It would be helpful for not using your phone all the time, but it's not really good for communities. Some people need to have communities online.
Honestly, I think it's a good thing. I think that kids generally just have a bit too much access to the internet, and There's a lot of really terrible influences online.
I make nail polish for boys. Nail polish, it's not very accepting for guys. Some people get bullied, will get targeted. My
brand. But not everyone is so upbeat. Lucas Lane is known as Glossy Boys online, sharing tips for boys who like wearing nail polish. He started at just 12 and has grown a community as well as a business. He and his mum Brianna, who helps him, think the ban is badly thought out.
First, I just didn't think it was a threat because, you know, it's just angry old people like, oh, ban social media. But now this is becoming a threat. And I didn't feel consulted. My mum, did you feel consulted?
Absolutely not.
This is affecting me, not the people making this law.
If you have a blanket ban, what you're doing is you're taking choices away from young people.
I want to see kids off their devices and onto the footy fields and the swimming pools and the tennis courts.
It was back in September that Prime Minister Anthony Albanese first mooted the idea of a social media ban. Many people want to know how it'll work. The government said the companies will be legally required to protect Australians from harm. They've now got a big chunk of time to come up with ways of doing that. Age verification is one suggestion. Daniel Angus is the Professor of Digital Communication at the Queensland University of Technology.
So there are two kinds of age verification that might be put into play. One is age verification proper, which is the handing over of personal details like passports, driver's licence, other forms of ID. That's problematic. In some ways, we're asking all of Australia to hand over those details if they want to be online, not just children. The other technology being talked about is age assurance, and that's the use of facial recognition or other kinds of AI. That is riddled with error. It still carries racial bias, gender bias, age bias, and is not a solution to this issue.
Hi, I'm Taylor, and I'd like to tell you a story about the time I accidentally shared way too much online.
Australia's touting it as a world-first ban. Who will be next? But perhaps more importantly, how will the platform step up to the new restrictions?
Be careful what you share on the internet, because once it's out there, it's out there.
And that was Katie Watson, our correspondent in Australia. While staying with the power of the big tech firms, the US government has proposed breaking up Google's monopoly on online searches by making it sell its Chrome browser. The Department of Justice also wants the company to stop paying smartphone manufacturers to make Google their default search engine. The plan follows a landmark ruling earlier in the year that Google was illegally forcing out its competition. The firm has described the Justice Department as pursuing a, quote, radical interventionist agenda. Well, I've been talking to antitrust expert Rebecca Hoare-Allensworth, who's a professor at Vanderbilt Law School in Tennessee. She told me why Chrome was at the heart of this case.
A lot of people use the Chrome browser, and the first thing they do when they go to their Chrome browser is they search. And so the idea is if somebody else had access to this browser, if somebody else owned it, then that would be a lot of eyeballs for a rival search competitor to develop. The problem here is scale. Another rival search product needs to have the scale necessary to compete.
The government also wants to go further, including placing restrictions on Google's search engine, where it's available, who it's available to. Are you surprised that the government has gone so far in this?
I'm not surprised. This is kind of a wish list, and it will be up to the judge to decide which among these things he's going to go for. And so it does make sense to ask for a lot and then hope that maybe you get half or two-thirds. And I also think that all of the remedies that are proposed here would address the competitive concerns. So they're not frivolous, but it's more than they're likely to get.
But it is essentially asking for Google to be broken up when it comes to the way that people access information on the internet, isn't it?
That's right. It's not only asking for the spin-off of Chrome, but there's also an ask potentially for a spin-off of Android. So, like I said, they really are asking for a lot. It's a breakup ask.
So is it then up to Google to come up with a series of counter proposals? Is that what happens next?
That's right. I mean, they will, you know, fight this and fight it hard, and it's going to take, sounds like, about 8 months for the judge to decide which among these he's going to do and to write his opinion. And even after that, it will be appealed. So there's a lot of litigation ahead about this issue.
Right. So what? I mean, it could take years to resolve, could it?
Potentially, yeah. It could take a year or two. I mean, maybe even three. It depends on how fast the appeals go.
And is whatever the judge decides once that appeals process has been gone through, I mean, is that binding?
It is. Once the appeals process has gone through, it is binding. The judge is the one that has the power to order Google to do whatever the judge wants it to do. Now, of course, that has to be upheld by appeal. It has to be consistent with American antitrust law. But the asks here contemplate the judge having control over this case for as long as maybe 10 years overseeing these remedies.
And if that is the case, is the potential then for this particular case to set precedent for other cases, for other big tech companies?
Not exactly precedent in the sense that the other cases would have to follow it. But yeah, it does set an example. It sets, let's say, the tone of how courts are viewing these big tech cases alleging monopoly.
Right. So it wouldn't set a legal precedent as such, but it might give an example. I mean, just one final thought. We've got obviously a new administration coming in a matter of weeks. Could that have an impact, do you think, if the new administration says, look, actually, you know, I think this is going in the wrong direction?
It could have an impact, but maybe less than you'd think. One of the reasons is because this suit has a lot of states listed as plaintiffs as well. So while the DOJ has, under Biden, been the real lead in this case, it's not possible for the new administration to completely make this case go away. And since they can't make it go away, I think they're probably likely to stay on the case. Will they push as hard? It's really hard to say, but the states are there too, and the states can push as hard as they want.
And that was Rebecca Hoare Allensworth, professor at Vanderbilt Law School in Tennessee in the US. You're listening to NewsHour from the BBC. Do stay with us. Yet more to come on this edition. This is James Menendez with NewsHour. Now, Ukraine says Russia's fired an intercontinental ballistic missile at the eastern city of Dnipro. If confirmed, it's almost certainly the first time such a weapon has been used in this war. Kyiv said an ICBM was launched from Russia's Astrakhan region on the Caspian Sea, and it comes after Ukraine used American and British-supplied long-range missiles to strike targets inside Russia. Let's talk to Matthew Saville, Director of Military Sciences at the UK security think tank, the Royal United Services Institute. Matthew, very good to have you with us. Was it an ICBM that Russia fired at Ukraine?
Good afternoon. We don't know at the moment, but it certainly seems to be some kind of missile that has a much longer range than the ones that have been used in this conflict so far. So those are mostly Iskanders. They're short range, 300 to 500 kilometers. This is something that appears to have been launched from between 800 to 1,000 kilometers away. And I think some of the disagreement over what we're calling it is sort of slightly quibbling around the edges.
Because
it might either have been an intermediate range missile, which has a range of up to 5,500 kilometers, or above that, in which case it's intercontinental. But you're talking about a very large missile with a long range.
But both those types of missiles, they haven't been used in this war, is that right?
No, indeed. And if this was an ICBM, I think actually that would be the first use of an ICBM anywhere in a conflict.
Yeah, because, I mean, for a layman like me, isn't that the sort of missile that's used to carry nuclear warheads?
It is indeed. You can put conventional warheads on these kind of things. But the fact is that this looks so very much like a political message, because in either case, it's a kind of large missile that you would traditionally associate with multiple nuclear warheads. Some of the weapons that Russia's been using thus far, the Kinjal and the Kalibr cruise missiles, can have small nuclear warheads. But this is the kind of thing that is, you know, essentially equivalent to the Trident missile that the UK has.
Does it change the military equation at all if it's just carrying conventional warheads? Or is it, as you say, just a symbol?
It doesn't radically change it, and that's because it's designed to drop multiple independent warheads that are nuclear tipped, so accuracy is less of an issue here. It doesn't matter if you are tens of meters out, although it might still be able to hit a specific target. So they can achieve much more accurate strikes with their existing cruise missiles. That's why it feels like this is much more political. First, we've got, you know, another class of missile to go to that's got bigger and got a longer range and kind of dwarfs that of things like Attackams and Storm Shadow, but also a message to the West that Russia is saying, well, we're not afraid to play around with these kind of weapons that traditionally would have been kept back for a nuclear attack.
And one last question, and briefly if you can, I mean, are there risks to Russia using this because of the sort of systems that detect, for example, an ICBM launch in the West?
There is a degree here to which they are, if you like, trying to toy with the West. Now, it appears that, you know, the West and Ukraine actually have good intelligence coverage of these sites. You would expect them to know what was going on there. But there is now a much greater degree of ambiguity. If a missile that comes from a test site, that launched from a weapon that looks like it could be nuclear, it's actually quite hard to tell what's going on. They can be spotted almost instantly by US space-based systems. But I think the Russians are trying to play around with notions of escalation.
Matthew, thank you very much indeed. Very useful analysis. Matthew Saville of the Royal United Services Institute there. Now, the Malaysian actress Michelle Yeoh's career spanned four decades. She started out as a martial arts actor, then became a key figure in the Hong Kong action scene. But it was her role in a James Bond film that catapulted her into Hollywood. And she's since starred in many hits, including Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and won an Oscar for Everything Everywhere All at Once. Well, Michelle Yeoh has been speaking to my colleague Nuala McGovern about how her first ambition was to be a ballerina.
I had aspirations of having my own ballet school back in Malaysia because my love was for the dance, the joy of expression on a dance floor and being able to teach that same kind of passion and love to little kids, little girls and boys, to be able to feel what I did. And so I came here to England. I went to the Hammond School of Dance in Chester because at that point, I think my dad was like, maybe you're a little young to be in London, so yes, it would be much better. And I think that was a great choice.
And you were going on this path to become a ballerina. But the fact that you've moved into acting and films came because you had what you called a shattered mirror moment, this huge disappointment when an injury meant that you would not be a ballerina. And you got that news as a young woman. And I'm wondering, we talk about that path and finding yourself, how did you regroup and find that path that took you to becoming the first Asian woman to win the Academy Award for Best Actress in a Leading Role?
I had that shattering glass moment because the specialist basically said to me, you can't do this kind of dancing from 9 till 5 because your back will just not be able to take it. But I was very blessed because Mrs. Hammond, the principal of the school, and I remember her so clearly in my head. She goes like, darling, it's okay. It's all right. Because, you know, there's so many paths to dance, to ballet. There's choreography, there's history, there's this, there's that. And she really helped me to find the Kru and Alsager College of Higher Education, where they did a degree in dance.
Mm-hmm.
So my horizon was no longer just ballet, mm-hmm, but into other things that could help.
And then, how did martial arts come into your life?
Well, I was given the opportunity to go to Hong Kong to do a commercial. And in that commercial, my first person that I ever worked with was Jackie Chan. I know.
You know, start at the top, Michelle, right?
I don't know how it happened. And then I was very fortunate because the production company, DNB, they're fairly new in the business in Hong Kong. And so they signed me up as an actress. And in the first movie, it was in Hong Kong in the heydays in the 80s, action movies, comedies were the box office, you know, the blockbusters.
Mm-hmm.
I looked at the whole action sequences and I thought, that's very similar to dance. It's all choreography. You know, you choreograph it and then you perform, execute it. So I bravely asked if, you know, it's possible that I could. And fortunately, one of the wives of the producers was like, and she was a great editor in her own right, says, yeah, you know, you bring Michelle. She's not a local girl, yet you fit her in the local box and do the same things. Why don't you open the box and let her try.
Give it a go.
Yeah. And it fails, put her back in the box again.
But you wouldn't go back in the box.
No, I wouldn't. I know. I guess it's just something that my parents always taught me, is like, believe in who you want to be.
Michelle Yeoh, bringing us to the end of this edition of NewsHour. I'll be back at the same time tomorrow. Until then, bye-bye.
Available now on the documentary from the BBC World Service.
I'm Jude Shapiro. I'm following the chaplains of Heathrow Airport. I'll be discovering what happens when faith, flight, and the stresses of Europe's busiest airport combine.
People are so often placed in our path just at the right time.
Listen now by searching for the documentary wherever you get your BBC podcasts.